Hello, and welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Blake McVeigh, and today I am speaking with author Mark Peresquia. The book is A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement, and it is published by Melville House. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess for the uninitiated, tell us just a little bit of background about who the subject of the book is.
The subject is Ernest Withers. For many Memphians, he's familiar territory. He, of course, was a brilliant photographer. He took some of the very pivotal photographs of the civil rights movement, in addition to documenting life in the African-American community in Memphis for over the course of 60 years. You know, his pictures were published all over the world. And back in the day, he was a studio photographer down on Beale Street, but he doubled as a freelance newsman for what they called the Black Press, the newspapers that published largely to African-American readers. And so his pictures would run all over the country in the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Cleveland Call and Post, others across the country. Some of his biggest pictures that he took are things that you may not know but will recognize, such as Dr. King riding one of the first integrated buses at Montgomery in 1956. He took a beautiful picture there with King right up front and a sea of white faces behind him, a very radical moment in history. He took a very famous picture, becoming more famous these days, at the Emmett Till trial when the young man's great uncle, Moses Wright, was on the witness stand and the judge had forbid any pictures taken during court session, but Ernest disobeyed the judge's orders and took this brilliant photo, slightly out of focus, but of Moses Wright standing and pointing to the accused killers, who were indeed the killers, but they were acquitted at trial, later admitted to doing it. Very powerful picture. And many others that, you know, the Little Rock Nine, James Meredith at Ole Miss, the Medgar Evers funeral, just on the sanitation strike, on and on and on. So Ernest was a very important historical figure. He probably has never gotten his due. He struggled all his life. Financially, he had 8 kids to feed. But his pictures are just really world-renowned.
So no matter what else happened, no matter what we discovered later, he was an important figure.
Absolutely. And I've told many people that nothing that he did for the FBI, in my view, eclipses the good that he did for the movement. I mean, he truly was an outstanding photographer of the 20th century who never got the acclaim that he deserved. Now, however, there is this hidden history which, you know, I uncovered through, you know, a long newspaper investigation and eventually a Freedom of Information suit that reveals a lot more about Ernest that wasn't known and how he and others collaborated with the FBI to keep watch in a period of very high paranoia, internal turmoil. The government and the FBI, led by J. Edgar Hoover, who, you know, historically now is viewed as quite a menacing figure, but they viewed many of these groups that were protesting public policy, you know, the war in Vietnam, the Jim Crow laws, et cetera. I mean, they viewed them with great suspicion. In the FBI's view, many of these people who were just advocates for, you know, improving rights were subversives. They viewed them as extremists, subversives, communists, and a lot of them were hurt by these investigations.
So not entirely unlike the whole McCarthy thing of the 50s.
Very similar. I mean, the key difference between the McCarthyism and the things that were going on in the 60s was that by that time, the courts had clipped the FBI's wings so much, saying, no, you can't do this. They had something called the Smith Act, where they were prosecuting people who were communists, who weren't necessarily advocating violent overthrow of the government. They got their wings clipped in court. And so Hoover just said, well, I'm going to go on with this regardless. He was kind of a law unto himself. And so a lot of these investigations, you know, probably the vast majority of them, were never anything that they were going to prosecute people in court. They were going to find other ways to contain them, either by having agents knock on doors of young activists of their parents and, you know, letting them know what they were doing, or, you know, trying to interfere with jobs. It happened in many cases. But it was a very pernicious, in many ways, you know, insidious, pernicious operation that they had going on, not only across the country, but here in Memphis as well.
So tell me a little bit about how you got started investigating this thing. What was the impetus for you?
The impetus was, I have to go way back in time. I've been at the Commercial Appeal for 29 years. I basically become an old man in Memphis. But back in 1997, I was covering James Earl Ray's hearings when he was still alive and trying to get out of prison. He was dying of liver disease, and he wanted to go home and die with his family. His lawyers were filing a number of pleadings in criminal court, raising all kinds of really crazy conspiracy theories that, you know, all sorts of entities were involved in the assassination of Dr. King, ranging from the FBI to the CIA and on and on and on. And 99% of this stuff was just, you know, baloney. Ray shot King. He probably did it because he was trying to collect a bounty offered by racist businessmen. But nonetheless, the King family endorsed these claims. King's younger son, Dexter, met Ray in prison, shook his hand, and told him, "We believe you, and we're going to do everything we can to get you out of prison." So this was a worldwide story at that point. And so I got quite a bit of latitude from the newspaper to dig into this. And I wrote various stories, some of them debunking these, some rather important, I think, stories and kind of unraveling a lot of the myth and mystery surrounding the assassination. But in the course of doing that, I was interviewing a number of former police, intelligence agents, FBI agents, Army, on and on and on. And I ran across an agent who knew kind of the real story of what was going around surrounding Dr. King's assassination. And, you know, the FBI, no matter what people might believe, there's a lot of good reason for believing that the FBI killed King, because they were trying to destroy him, no question about it. But they did not kill Dr. King. But they were surveilling him, and they were surveilling numbers of others who they deemed to be, subversive traitors, viewed very suspiciously. And so they had the area of the Lorraine Motel covered with informants, as they did throughout the mid-late 60s, And this is when he revealed to me, this agent, that Ernest Withers had been an informant for the FBI. His point was is that, we didn't need any electronic surveillance or this other stuff that people allude to because we had so many informants. And he told me a bit at that time about what Ernest had done for the FBI. He said he was a really good informant, and any activist who came through town, he would get photos and reports on. They were trying to, make sure that these agitators, as they viewed them, didn't cause trouble, didn't start riots, didn't stir up the locals, And so, but the agent would not go public with this. He told me he would deny it. Really, I just kind of forgot about it. And it wasn't until years later, more than 10 years later, after Mr. Withers died, that I began, I thought, I don't have anything to lose. I'll file a Freedom of Information Act request, which is typical when people of historical significance die. You've got numbers of media interests or right. historians filing what they call FOIAs. And I did that. Ernest had a file from the late 70s because after the civil rights period waned, because he became a state liquor agent for the Blanton administration and got involved in a lot of corruption and was prosecuted by the U.S. attorney here in Memphis. And he was all part of the clemency for cash scandal that brought down the Blanton administration. And because of that, there was a file on him, an FBI file on him that I was able to get through Freedom of Information Act. And in that file was a clue about what he'd been doing earlier as an informant for the FBI. And in there, it was a background report, and it referred to said Ernest Columbus Withers was formally designated as ME338R, which at that point I knew just enough to recognize as an informant number. And I was able to get other records, that had been released through the Freedom of Information Act from the late 60s period related to the sanitation strike and investigation of the Invaders, which was a local homegrown Black Power organization. And I found that the FBI made that same mistake over and over again, where they were supposed to redact this confidential information, the code number ME338R, and they failed to do so. And it's a unique identifier because these informant numbers are sequentially assigned. Like if you come in and be an informant for the FBI, you're informant number one, the next guy is informant number two, the next guy is number three, and on. So it's a unique identifier. And every time it appears, you can just substitute his name, and which is what I did initially in my initial reports back in 2010. Was able to reveal some of the things that Ernest was doing for the FBI in monitoring the sanitation strike. And then after that, I hooked up with a relative of the FBI agent who had handled Ernest, a guy named Special Agent William H. Lawrence, who ran the domestic intelligence operations, rooting out communists and subversives and others in Memphis over the course of basically a quarter century, from the late 40s to 1970. He was deceased by then, but his daughter shared with me a number of records that he had kept in his possession, handwritten notes that referred to Ernest by name and by code number. And eventually we sued the FBI. I wrote these stories and they denied it. And they continued to deny it until we kept winning in court, even though the odds were stacked against us because these laws protect informants and they can lie. And the law actually allows the FBI to lie about informants. They don't have to admit anybody was ever informant, and they were relying on this law. But we had a sympathetic judge, and a confluence of factors came together that they were forced to admit in court he was an informant. And then we eventually reached a mediated settlement where a number of records, hundreds of records, were released as part of this settlement over the course of several years, which is the basic foundation of my book.
Did you uncover anything in particular about Withers himself that may explain his motivation for going through with this?
Well, as part of the mediated settlement, they never gave us his informant file itself. What they did was they reached a compromise and they said, there are numbers of reports in his informant file that were also copied to case files. Like if they were investigating, for example, James Forman, who they were when he came to town, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which they had a rather thick file on, anytime Ernest had any involvement in those investigations, the report would be copied to numerous files, like his informant file or the SCLC file, or if they were investigating Forman, it would be Forman's file. And so they said, what we'll do is we don't want to reach into his file. And there's a lot of other sensitive information in his file, including things like how they recruited him, how much he was actually paid, perhaps written instructions that he might have received in advance. And they weren't willing to release that, but they were saying, you can get almost the same thing. And a lot of these photos that he took aren't in the informant file. They're in the case files. And so you're going to get photos and reports. And so, but that was the deal that was reached. And so it was through that method of releasing these files. He had like dozens and dozens of times that he informed on Reverend Jim Lawson, for example, that show up in reports over a course of years. And so it was just a matter of collecting that, put it all in a spreadsheet and trying to quantify, you know, what he was doing, how he was doing it. His motivations, they are still left to be interpreted because there's no document that says Ernest Withers has agreed to cooperate with us because X, Y, or Z. What we do know is that the FBI stipulated as part of this settlement that he was paid a little bit more than $20,000 over these 18 years, 1958 to 1976, that he was cooperating with him. Doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but you've got to consider inflation. $20,000 in that period would be roughly about $150,000 today. And so if he was getting, say, $8,000 a year, I mean, that could be a lot of money, especially as somebody who had eight kids to feed.
Right.
It could buy gas, put gas in your car. It could put food on the table. It could help you pay a mortgage. And so this is the thing, is that Ernest was very family driven. We know that. He was a family man. I mean, he was a lot of other things too, but no one will ever say Ernest Withers didn't take care of his family. Mm-hmm. He was very much a family man, loved his family, and was loved by the wider community. So money factored into it. The agent who first told me about it said that he believed Ernest was in it for the money. He didn't really have a political angle in it. But then too, Ernest was a World War II veteran. He was conservative in that regard. He had three sons in the 60s in the military, one of them in Vietnam. I mean, so he was very invested in the military. And this is, I think, one reason why he helped them to the degree that he did as far as monitoring the peace movement, which he did quite a bit. They would give him assignments because basically what they were doing is they were cataloging the movement. That's a big thing where he helped them out, is that they wanted to identify. You got, like, let's say you've got 80 people out there marching, a lot of them are college kids. They don't know who these people are. It's not like today where you can get on the internet and Google somebody. With his pen and paper and his camera, would go out there and say, you know, take their pictures. They would tell them in advance, we want good identification pictures of who these people are, good face shots where you can see what they are. And he would get their names. He would get their occupations in many cases. That he knew, particularly in the black community, he knew everybody. Mm-hmm. This was easy for him to do. He could do this in his sleep. But I do think, you know, one of his motivations was he was a bit more conservative than a lot of the people who were marching in the streets, particularly when it came to the war. because he was a World War II veteran. He was 15 to 20 years older than a lot of these activists. So you've got money, you've got conservative orientation. He always wanted to be a policeman too, and this is the thing.
I remember you mentioning that in the book.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the, what they called the original nine, which was the first nine African-American police officers in Memphis in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. There were some African-American officers back in the days of Reconstruction, but he was part of that first class. Unfortunately, it didn't go well for him. I mean, he got fired for bootlegging. He was in a conspiracy with a bootlegger to, you know, sell petty stuff, but selling whiskey to people at concerts at the Hippodrome, you know, without a license, splitting the profits with them. He got kicked off for that. And then, of course, he had that other subsequent scandal with later after the mm-hmm. Civil Rights Movement. So, I mean, I think it basically lies in those three areas: the need for money, his political views, conservative orientation, and just that he always wanted to be a cop.
I guess it's just another way of saying that, you know, Ernest Withers was not, you know, a flat character in a book, or he was not just the photographer. He was a, you know, complex, nuanced individual.
Absolutely.
With his own motivations. To use a modern day term, it's as if he viewed this as his side hustle.
Exactly.
And he, you know, he got some benefit out of it. Do you feel, or is there any evidence that any of the work that he did really led anyone to any harm?
There is. When you read a lot of these reports, they seem benign because there's just like, it's almost like somebody's trying to fill up a scrapbook with information, name after name. This guy's doing this, this guy's doing that. This guy just got a job as a janitor. This guy is driving a taxi. He lives over here at such and such a place. But you got to remember, the FBI was a law enforcement agency. They were not keeping a scrapbook. They were trying to keep tabs on who these people were. They wanted to know what they were doing. They wanted current information. They wanted current photos. A lot of times they would take these photos and make copies and give them to the police department or give them to other FBI field offices. They were tracking these individuals. And there are numbers of cases where people got hurt. And I can give you some examples of that. Bobby Doctor, who is now 78 and retired and living in Georgia, back in 1968, he was a field representative with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission here in Memphis. He was a longtime activist in the movement. I mean, he was involved in the early sit-in movements, but he went to work for the government. And while he was here in Memphis, the FBI office deemed that he was too close to the Black Power movement, that he was too sympathetic with them. And by his own admission, you know, he did associate with some of the Black Power advocates, but he also associated with a lot of the other people in the movement. He felt it was his job to get to know who's who, and he was teaching some Black awareness courses to some of the invaders and doing some other things that really got him into a lot of trouble. And Ernest was part of this investigation of him. By Bobby's account, Bobby almost got fired from his job because the FBI, they were all in the same building, that federal building downtown, came down to his office one day and delivered what he calls a thick report on all of his activities. And it's all the stuff that he's doing. Of course, he didn't know it, but some of it's coming from Ernest. In these reports, as an example, Ernest tells Bill Lawrence that he saw Bobby Doctor at a march, and Bobby Doctor was holding some woman's hand. As the report says, Bobby's married and this woman is married, but they ain't married to each other. And he wanted that picture, and he got Ernest to give him that picture. Now, did they act on that? I don't know. Were they prepared to act on it? Obviously, they were. They tried to get him fired from his job. Bobby had an associate there, Rosetta Miller, who was also deemed to be too close to the Black Power movement, and they went after her in a similar manner, and Ernest gave them identification photos of her, told her that she was a rumor monger, somebody who would give aid and comfort, is how Bill Lawrence put it, to the Black Power movement. She nearly lost her job. It really is kind of almost a parallel to the Red Scare of the 50s, you know, where guilt by association. That's one of the things that the FBI was trying to do. They wanted to eviscerate the invaders, and that meant not only cutting out the legs of the actual activists who were involved in that, but their supporters and sympathizers as well. They were going to do what they called a counterintelligence action against the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and they wanted to charge some of these guys with sedition. I mean, do you ever hear of anybody getting charged with sedition? It's very rare.
Yes.
Well, doesn't happen every day, though.
I mean, like, yes, it's very rare.
Well, the thing is that probably the FBI and Ernest Withers' involvement in investigating the Withers probably was the closest thing you would get to, I think, would be like a legitimate terrorism investigation, in that some of these people in that movement were, you know, they were like committing arson and doing other acts. And so there was one wing there. But I mean, the vast majority of that whole Black Power movement, there was a lot of rhetoric they would talk about, you know, bringing down the country and that. But they were basically involved in trying to instill pride in African Americans. They were very much into economic empowerment and other things. And he was involved in investigating the Black Panthers at one time. And they had a breakfast program for children. I mean, they were the movement across the country, and that the militant movement across the country and in Memphis, I mean, was largely benign. They weren't the threat that Hoover and the FBI made them out to be. But I mean, there are numbers of other examples of things that Ernest did where people did get hurt. A couple other examples is he helped the FBI investigate what was called back in those days the New Left, which is basically campus radicals, and various outshoots of it, the peace movement, the Communist Party. Bill Lawrence had eviscerated the Communist Party in the 1950s in Memphis. It virtually ceased to exist, and they were very proud of that. But in the late 60s, they started to reemerge through something called the Young Workers Liberation League, which was a bunch of young kids who, you know, a couple of them had signed cards with the Communist Party, and they were all after these guys. In one of the reports, this is the early 70s, the report says that Ernest, that he, as instructed, had gone to the office of one of these guys, a guy named Mark Allen, actually, who's a famous flamenco guitarist here now, but had gone to his office. He worked for Chandler Wrecking and had been able to somehow or another get his hands on his employment file and saw that where his home address was and also his social security number, which he accurately reported to the FBI. And, you know, Mark says, yeah, that's my social security number. I interviewed him. The interesting thing is after they did that, they tried to get him fired, and a couple agents went there and said, you know, that, you know, this guy's a communist. And they were going, yeah, I mean, he's a truck driver, you know, I mean. And they would do other things. Like, there was another member of that group and others as well. Ernest got his phone number through his reporting, gave it to the FBI. And what the FBI did with that was they would do warrantless searches of your toll charges. They had a source that Bill Lawrence had. He had sources all over the place. Go to the phone company, and they would look and see all your toll charges. They wanted to figure out who you're talking to, who your associates were. You know, were these communists? Were they subversives? They were mapping this all out, this vast conspiracy to overthrow the country, which never existed. And so, yeah, people were hurt. We'll never know the many ways that people were hurt, because they were in constant, the FBI worked in constant collaboration with MPD and helped them form their own intelligence unit over there, which I sometimes call FBI Light. But and the things they did over there were probably far more atrocious. The ACLU sued them in the late 70s and convinced a judge to disband them. And there's a consent order that Memphis is still subject to this day, where the police cannot engage in political surveillance. But all this information was being swapped back and forth, pictures, you know, tidbits about people, what they were doing. One of the things the FBI did, they would constantly send the police different things about, you know, what they would hear about drug use, cars not being properly registered. And Ernest turned over a lot of tag numbers to them. And they would harass these guys by, you know, like trying to get them on all kinds of, like trying to slow them down, ding them here, there, and everywhere they could. And so, yeah, I mean, people were hurt by this. There's no question about it.
It's hard for me not to think of similarities between that time, the issues you're talking about. It just makes me wonder, is some of the same kind of stuff going on today? You're not a spy, are you?
No. Well, no, as far as, you know, nobody's ever paid me anything other than my employer at the Commercial Appeal. But, you know, it is a good question. I think this is an issue that, you know, was relevant then, is relevant today, will be relevant next week, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, because you're always going to have that tension between the need to protect the country, the need to have law and order, not have civil unrest, protect property and life. You're always going to have that. And then that tension on the other side from people who were mistreated. The government is not honoring their deal with them and giving them their full rights. There's always going to be that tension. And how the government handled that is an interesting question. But, you know, all of the stuff, you know, the big picture stuff about what the FBI was doing came out in congressional hearings back in the 70s, and the Church Committee looked into a lot of this. And so the FBI reformed its ways. I mean, they got rid of this vast intelligence network that they had, which Ernest was part of. They had informers all over the place. And they really reeled it all in to the point where they went from having, at one point, I think it was, they said they had like 10,000 or more intelligence informants, domestic intelligence informants, and they went down to just a handful. They got out of the business altogether to where these days, I mean, you've got to have probable cause. They can do an initial investigation, but I mean, you've got to be investigating actual crime, not political views or ideas and that, but right. Actual, you know, plan, I'm going to blow up this building, you know. But, you know, you still hear to this day, I mean, there's always going to be abuses. But they're done secretly, so we don't know what the abuses are. There are a lot of people in Memphis spinning out of the Black Lives Matter movement and some of these other movements, with people affiliated with the Mid-South Peace and Justice Center, who believe that they have been unlawfully surveilled by MPD. And some of these individuals were, you know, there was some news stories last fall about them being on a blacklist going into City Hall. So this is something that's, it's always going to be there creeping up, you know, and you got to keep an eye on it, but it's how the government handles it. It's a delicate balancing act to make sure that people's rights are enforced and that, you know, but that we have security, law and order.
Some budding reporter that might be 5 years old now and 20, 25, 30 years, they might be filing a Freedom of Information
yes.
Act and
this will never
finding
go away.
Out about what's going on today.
It'll never go away. This is always going to be an issue at some level.
One thing that I read in the press kit for your book really intrigued me. It said, you hope that the story of Withers will help fill in the gaps that still exist in the twin histories of civil rights and government surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything from those gaps, as they're called in that quote, that you feel like you haven't yet covered in this interview?
There are a lot of gaps.
So way more time than we have.
Well, yeah, and I can just give you an example, though. I mean, you know, it came out years ago that Maxine and Vasco Smith had cooperated with the FBI. We've learned more about that relationship over time, and it wasn't maybe as pernicious as some people envisioned in that, as far as anyone knows, they were never paid. It wasn't like they were, you know, like Ernest Withers was paid.
Right.
I mean, he was paid for photographs and information, intel that he was given them. They had a relationship that the FBI cultivated, Bill Lawrence did it, where we don't really know what all they did. But they were informing, they were giving up plans, and this part I can't prove, but I believe there's some detail in my book. It's in the, it comes out, came out in some of these records that early on in like mid-60s, Bill Lawrence was trying to prove that Dr. King was having an affair with Harry Belafonte's ex-wife.
Right.
That came from some local people, and the names were redacted, but I believe they were Maxine and Vasco Smith because they fit so neatly, and their names will fit into the space of the redaction and just the, you know, who they were, a couple, a civil rights movement couple. The glove fits. Whether it was them, I don't know. But, I mean, these are the kind of things, is that who were these informers? Because they had a lot of informers at different levels who were doing lots of things, and some were more valued, like Ernest, because he knew so many different people and had the access. But, I mean, these are the things that we don't know. But over time, you get more and more clues because, you know, the Freedom of Information Act's a great thing. And as more and more information comes out, they make more mistakes. And one of the things in the afterword in my book I talk about, I came across this report that was released as part of the Kennedy assassination, the unfolding Kennedy assassination records that are still coming out. And there was a report from late 1963, early 64, shortly after the assassination in Dallas, in which the FBI told all its field offices, you know, find out what's behind this. And so Bill Lawrence had tapped all of his sources, not all of them, but a lot of them. And they're named in there. They didn't redact them. Ernest Withers was one of them. There were several other names. Most of these guys, when I started looking into them, I'd never heard of them before, appear to be people that they were recruiting within the white extremist movement here locally, the Ku Klux Klan and others. And there's a lot of very intriguing leads for somebody who's got the curiosity, the time, the resources to dig into. I mean, you know, these informers, this wasn't all bad. I mean, the FBI, law enforcement, lives and dies by informants. You know, they got to have them, especially when you're dealing with crime, you know, mm-hmm. to get information from people who don't want to give it up. You know, in organizations like the Klan, I mean, I think there's a lot of legwork that was laid in this book and, you know, and just in this whole process of digging into this, that historian PhD candidates could probably feed off this for years because there's a lot of fertile ground there to fill in these gaps that we still don't know, you know, what was going on.
So you feel like your book begins to fill in some of the gaps.
Yeah.
But still so much more to do.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, there's a lot of historical research to be done to really understand that whole era. I mean, it was an era of, you know, paranoia, polarization, a lot of fear. I mean, there were individuals who were willing to inform on their fellow citizens, you know, for whatever reasons, money or political views. You know, it's been said that, you know, it wasn't hard for, like with the peace movement, a lot of people to inform on them because, you know, this country was so divided over the war. And even though now, historically, we look at it and it's viewed as an unjust war in the time, the majority of America supported the Vietnam War.
Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, the book is A Spy in Canaan by author Mark Parascia, published by Melville House.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.